Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC Foxhole on Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play. Today on the Politics Podcast, raising the age, federal funding to fight the opiate crisis, an unflattering audit, and Southeast Asian dishes. Here to make sense of it all is Rose Hoban, editor and legislative reporter at North Carolina Health News. Hello, Rose.
Hey, Jeff.
How are you?
Good. There's no atheists in foxholes this week. We're all saying, oh my God, help us. There's just so much happening.
It was quiet last couple of weeks. No, it wasn't. Last week was a Senate budget.
Senate budget was
pretty
busy.
Prior to that. But this is
pretty
busy week as
well. There was one quiet week.
Yeah.
Right? Because we had crossover, which was, you know, as crossover is, insane.
It's a zoo.
It's 14-hour days for you and me, day after day after day. Then the following week was pretty quiet because they all the legislators stayed home and there were mostly skeleton sessions. And then last week, on to the Senate budget, which we are all parsing. It's how many?
368 is the policy. But then if you had the money report, we're at, what, 750 pages
it's
maybe?
It's just ridiculous amounts
of
policy.
Right. When you say ridiculous, I mean, you're not judging the budget. You're saying just it's a ridiculous quantity of stuff to sift through and make sense of.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, every year at North Carolina Health News, we do a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And we go through budget, essentially section by section, line by line. There's so much policy in there that I'm having, you know, it'll be 8 lines of text. I'm having to spend a half hour going back and reading general statute because they're creating policy and putting it in the budget document.
Right.
And it's just, this has been a particular, I'd say this is the 6th time I've done this. This is the most dense Senate budget I've ever seen.
One of the most challenging things, I think, about the entire budget marathon is you go from governor to one of the chamber, depending on which year it is. This year, the Senate starts, then over to the House, then to conference, and finally, a conference report comes out that we in the public, we in the media, the press can digest. We have no idea whether we're talking about the right school in Durham or whether we're talking about whatever policy piece it may be. Some of this stuff is simply a negotiating tactic and tool. I don't have the insight or the intel to tell you what's a game, what's a token, what's BS.
We're not behind that closed door where this stuff gets hashed out.
So keeping that, I guess, in mind as we move forward, there's a lot of policy in the Senate budget, and I think they alluded to this a little bit. Some of it is purely for negotiating purposes.
Oh, I've had multiple people. I'm asking. I go around asking, you know, about a 4-line section, and I say, well, what the heck is this? And someone will say, oh, it'll come out in the House budget.
Wait,
I'm like, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be reporting on it.
That it shouldn't receive scrutiny, and that there doesn't need to be a spotlight or some analysis and discussion on it. So one of the big things, as we think about the budget, that the House and the Senate are going to have to work out, as we've said many times in recent weeks, you and I in the press room, me and other guests here on the podcast, tax policy. Okay, that's one. We'll set that aside for the moment. The other thing that I think is pretty significant is raise the age. And we're going to get to the negotiation in a minute, as to, you know, where the bill goes from here. But let's start with raise the age. It moved this week through the North Carolina House. This is something that you have been covering for years. The chamber voted overwhelmingly to approve the bill. This is a proposal that would, by and large, send teenagers into the juvenile justice system rather than automatically trying them as adults. And it has taken literally years for this to move through just one chamber. How significant was this?
Yeah, we have been reporting on this, I think, as long as I've been legislative reporter for North Carolina Health News since 2012. This has been floating around the building. It got through the House and the House only in 2014. And, you know, it's been incredibly fraught. There's been resistance from many quarters, including resistance sometimes from interesting and odd corners. So for example, in 2014, I got a chance to go to the Mecklenburg County Jail with the Mecklenburg sheriff, and he toured me around, and I asked him about Raise the Age at that point in time, and he was a guy in Mecklenburg County Jail. You actually have a Charlotte Mecklenburg school that's accredited as a Charlotte Mecklenburg school within that jail. And he was concerned about Raise the Age because they had done so much good work there that they were afraid they were going to lose it, right? So it came from all kinds of quarters that there was resistance to Raise the Age. But there's been a consensus. And the reason why we've covered it at North Carolina Health News, and I think one of the primary concerns mm-hmm. of a lot of people has been that these young people that end up in the adult in particular, in the adult penal system.
Young adults,
yeah. But they end up in the adult penal system. Mm-hmm. They end up being sexually molested frequently, like at something like 8 to 10 times more likely to be.
Far more likely to be victims of sexual assault.
Far more likely to be victims of sexual assault. And then this idea that many of these young people who are caught up in the adult system are diagnosable, have mental health disabilities, mental health problems when they enter the adult system. And these only get worse because they're not getting treated in prison. And then they come out and they have trauma on top of it. Mm-hmm. If you talk to some of the folks within the juvenile justice system right now, there's like a juvenile detention in the state. There's about 200 young people in juvenile detention in the state. Folks in the Department of Correction or DPS, Department of Public Safety, will tell you that all but one of those young people have a diagnosable mental health disorder.
So we think about these young adults who are incarcerated. There's the mental health component. There's, unfortunately, it sounds like a much higher rate of being victimized by sexual assault. And this in turn, I would imagine, I mean, from the research I've seen, you've covered this much more closely than I have, but this in turn cranks up the recidivism rates. And this makes it much more likely that these folks are going to be return visitors to prison.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that is one of the concerns and that's one of the arguments for Raise the Age, is that you put young people into the juvenile system where there's intense court involvement, intense, where parents are required to be involved, all of these things. What ends up happening is that, you get to address these problems early on. And they see other states that have done this have seen recidivism rates drop.
And every other state has done this to date. North Carolina is the last state in the United States that has not either raise the age or established policy to raise the age.
New York State, which is my home state, only just this winter actually raised the age.
Right.
So it's been done statutorily,
statutorily,
and it's being implemented now.
All right. I do want to give, you noted this, but I would like you to just note briefly or address the arguments against this still. It was I believe, a 104-8 vote this
Correct.
Week in the House. It moved through overwhelmingly, but there was some debate on it. One of the arguments against doing this right now is a fiscal perspective. What's the biggest argument, or I mean, how would you parcel that out?
That was the concern for folks. Now here's the deal.
And why is it more money?
So it's more money because you're going to have to build some facilities, and you're going to have to sort of separate things. You have to separate juveniles which you are supposed to separate juveniles from adults now, as per the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act that was passed under George W. Bush. And that's supposed to have been happening, but in many jails,
mm-hmm.
not so much prisons, which are state entities, but jails, which are county entities.
Right.
That's not really been happening because they don't have the resources.
Right.
This will
yeah.
really compel this
okay.
to happen. So that's part of the reason why you had sheriffs and DAs to some extent resisting this over time.
Not so much opposed to the policy, opposed to the implementation. They're
because
saying,
it would cost them money.
Yeah,
it would
yeah,
cost them
yeah.
money. So there's that. there's a fiscal note out there. You know, there's estimates of how much it will cost, and that was an objection by some lawmakers. However, the counter to that by bill sponsors is that in every other state where this has been implemented, one, there have been savings because you reduce recidivism, you reduce the number of young people in jail, and then you also reduce the crime rates in general because, you know, you have these kids who are not charged and or who go through a process. And so then they're, you know, released to their parents' supervision. And so and then, you know, you prevent more crime. Right. So that's part of it. And, you know, part of the problem so often is that lawmakers are constrained by this whole 2-year budget cycle that matches a 2-year election cycle. Mm-hmm. So they want to be able to go home to their constituents and say, hey, we saved money over this, you know, but if you're going to have to spend 50 or 70 million to implement this over a few years, and it's always harder to see money that you didn't have to spend, mm-hmm. right? It's always hard to account for a negative. And so, you know, in the balance sheet, it feels like there's only a spend and not the savings. And so I think that was a real issue for some lawmakers. Obviously not a lot of them, because I think most lawmakers in the House have been convinced that this is going to be a money saver over time.
In many ways, politics has become an increasingly rare long-term game.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just the nature of election cycles, so on and so forth.
Right.
Before we move to a couple of other topics, I want to ask you about how this is going to move forward, if this is going to move forward. Does it die after moving through the House? Are we going to see it as a separate bill with a poison provision in the budget? Do you have a guess? It's still early.
I don't like making predictions because I'm almost always wrong. Right. Yeah. However, there are some folks who have, you know, posited a bunch of different paths forward. There is policy language in the Senate budget around raising the age, but they do not appropriate.
They have money for a study commission.
Yet another study commission. It's called paralysis by analysis. You study something, and you know we've had multiple studies in this state. Last year there was a study that was done by Chief Justice Mark Martin. You know, like
a registered Republican.
But I don't know how much more study you need,
sure.
Right? So, but it's that you can push things down, you can kick the can down the road by studying it a little bit
sure.
more. So there's money for a study, but they kick the can for appropriation around this down to 2020. So that's in the Senate budget. The other, you know, maybe that's what, right, that maybe that's the Senate's negotiating position and the two chambers find their compromise somewhere in the middle. Maybe it's that the final language will not include lower level felonies.
Right. Or all felonies.
Possible. Well, I mean, like most of the felonies are not there.
Right.
Right. It's A through E. You know, most people, I didn't know about classes of felonies, but, you know, felonies A through E, those are things like, you know, premeditated murder and stuff. Like, obviously, these are going to be, if there's a juvenile who does this, they'll be charged as an adult. Right. But, you know, stuff like marijuana possession, that's a low level felony. That's like a felony I. And, you know, it's possession with intent to distribute. So if you have two joints in your pocket and you're going to give one to your friend, that would be a felony I.
Right?
So will that be stripped out of it? We don't know.
Right.
So and that maybe that's where it'll go. There's some advocates who say that, well, maybe we go forward. I mean, I talked to Tom Murray, who's with the Administrative Office of the Courts, and his quote was like, well, you know, we've got everyone talking about misdemeanors, and maybe now we pass misdemeanors only, and then we come back a few years from now and say, hey, look, this is what it did. It, like, reduced recidivism, reduced the crime rate, and then we can roll felonies in. Who knows? Who knows what the final is going to be? Who knows?
Politics.
Who knows how to predict what the Senate will do?
Rose Hoban is the guest here on the WNC Politics podcast. You can follow her on Twitter
at Rose Hoban and read her work and some of her colleagues' work as well at NorthCarolinaHealthNews.org. A couple of other topics I'd like to work through relatively quickly. Also this week, Governor Roy Cooper announced a $31 million federal grant to help combat the opioid crisis and the number of deaths that have unfortunately been on the rise in recent years with opiate overdoses and opiate overdose-related deaths. $31 million. What do you make of that, if anything?
Well, it's more than the governor and folks had asked for in the STOP Act, which had asked for $20 million. The House appropriated in the neighborhood of $10 or $12 million of, you know, some of the activities that were named in the STOP Act. Some of it has to do with interdiction. Some of it has to do with reclassification. Some of it has to do with law enforcement. I mean, you know, $31 million, it depends on how you spend it.
Sure.
Are you doing prevention? Are you doing treatment? Treatment's not cheap. And we don't have a lot of treatment beds in North Carolina for substance abuse or substance use. And I've said for a decade or more that substance use is the red-headed stepchild in the mental health budget in North Carolina. So, you know, if some of this is going toward treatment, hey, that would be great. But I have not yet been able to parse how this is going to be distributed out.
You were you still carry the card. You were a nurse.
I am working. A nurse.
You are a nurse, and you worked as a nurse for
Correct.
Two decades.
And I worked in drug treatment.
And you worked in drug treatment. So what I'm wondering about is we think about the STOP Act, which is this piece of policy that's moved from the House to the Senate. It changes the guidelines for opiate prescribing practices here in the state. And there's a lot of attention on this issue. This is a hot political issue right now. Republicans and Democrats, they want to talk about it. They want to tell you that they're gonna work on this problem. They're going to fix it. I mean, Josh Stein, and we'll see if he runs for something down the road, this is I think, going to be a hallmark of his resume. And I don't mean this in a judgy way or a disparaging way, other than to say this is a good political, right political item right now.
Oh yeah, this was strategic.
Right, but as a nurse, as somebody who knows the public health world better than me and better than many of our listeners, is there a looming effort out there that hasn't been addressed? Is there something that needs to be done?
Oh my gosh! I guess I'd say treatment beds.
Yeah.
Treatment beds. You know, it's
that's not too late in the game. I mean,
well.
Should it be more prevention?
Well, and prevention too. But I mean, like, it's, boy, you could just, it's like buckshot. You know, you could aim stuff at every layer, right? You know, but right now, you know, you think about like something like NA, Narcotics Anonymous.
Yeah.
You know, just by using that, you don't get the good long-term outcomes. You know, I think these days, the evidence-based work is showing that the best way to keep people from relapsing, because addiction is a relapsing disease, right? Mm-hmm. And the things that allow people to prevent relapse are, you know, full reeducation, reintegration into communities without, you know, what do I say? Without like, you can't go home again in a lot of ways. You can't go back to the neighborhood where you used to use with your buddies, right? You have to, a lot of times, people with addiction issues, like, they need to relearn how to socialize. Maybe they need job skills. Maybe they need employment skills. So a lot of this stuff takes time. You can talk to folks from TROSA in Durham. Mm-hmm. Or the folks up on Dix Hill, Healing Transitions. And, you know, they'll tell you that there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And then you can talk to people in the recovery community. There's this whole new movement within addiction, it's the recovery movement.
Yeah.
It's more than just saying, stop using. It's more about why. Like, what are your hopes and dreams? How can you, you know, use those as a way to keep yourself from using again. And, you know, so some of this stuff it doesn't take lots of money, some of it, but, you know, like funding things like collegiate recovery, like programs in colleges that help people to have fun at college that don't involve drugs or alcohol,
right?
Right? And so some of this stuff can be really strategically done. Like you can stop someone from really developing an addiction early. So there's all kinds of places to intervene, and a lot of it will depend on how they use this money.
I feel like everybody has an opiate story, whether that pertains to them in a prescription or somebody they know or a neighbor or a parent. What's yours?
Oh, mine.
It doesn't have to be unique to you.
No. I have a couple opiate stories. Mostly it's about over prescription.
Okay.
So I had to have abdominal surgery in 2014, and I had the surgery on a Tuesday. I had one of those pumps, right? So I'm using the pump, and they discontinued the pump by Friday, because in addition to getting morphine, I was also getting a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which actually was doing a lot for me. So they discontinued me off the pump on Friday. I took one oxycodone on Friday afternoon, and then Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I didn't need it, but I still had some complications that kept me in the hospital. Monday, I'm being discharged, and the resident says to me, do you need anything? And I said, well, it might be good to have a dozen when I go home, just in case something happens. She wrote for 90 pills. I used one of those pills. There were 80, and I shouldn't be saying this on the radio because now it makes my house into a target. So I have thrown them away.
Right.
I have thrown them away because it was 3 years ago, but I didn't want them around. But I looked at this bottle and I was like, this is ridiculous. This is why there's so many pills sloshing around out there. Right. And that was something that's addressed in the STOP Act.
It is
overprescribing.
Right.
Right.
When you're talking about 80, 90, 100 pills, and if those pills have a value of $10 to $20.
Oh, believe me, I run a small not-for-profit. You know, there was a thought, oh, no, can't do that. You know, but
that's it. That's $1,600 to $2,000 worth of.
Absolutely.
There's thousands of dollars street value in these pills. We will. I guess maybe this is a smooth transition from opiates and you not selling them out of your house because.
No. I brought them to a Dropbox at my local police department.
Because otherwise, you could get in trouble with Beth Wood, the state auditor. See, this is a seamless transition. No, not at all. We're moving from opiates to Beth Wood and an audit that took place this week.
Well, it's an audit that dropped this week. The
yes.
audit took place in August,
yes.
September,
Thank
October,
you.
Right.
The report that came out detailed misuse of funds at North Carolina's largest managed care organization.
It's a mental health managed care organization.
Okay. So Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions provides service for about 85,000 folks with mental illness and
850,000.
850,000.
850. That's their service area. So there's
that
a potential
huge.
Of 850,000 okay. people. They don't
okay.
serve all those people, but
right.
it's their potential audience.
Okay. The audit from Wood's office says that Cardinal improperly authorized more than $1 million in salaries, spent money on strategic planning that should have gone toward behavioral health services.
Oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Pick
honey,
it up,
buddy.
There, my friend.
My word. Wow, there's some great stuff in this audit. I mean, it's really juicy
great
reading.
Great or juicy? Okay.
It's juicy reading. This is the kind of stuff that we don't get to see that often as
yeah.
reporters. But let me see. One is a no-bid $10,000 contract that was given to this woman, Rory Riley, who had the skill set. So you got to give it to her. She had the skill set. But she was, at the time, in a relationship with Richard Topping, who is now the CEO, but at the time he was the general counsel.
I'm drinking water. That would be what I would classify as a conflict of interest.
Tiny. But she did have the skills. She did have the skill set that the contract stipulated, right? But still,
it raises an
eyebrow.
Sure.
It raises an eyebrow.
Give me a couple others
that jumped
out at you today.
There were so many that jumped out at me. Let me see. Well, I mean, I guess the first thing is Richard Topping's salary. But the really juicy stuff is the parties.
Yeah,
there was a $9,800 Christmas party that was hosted at Topping's house.
$9,800?
$9,800. Some of it included decorations. The Cardinal folks argue that these are not illegal expenditures. However, it's the optics. It's not about even the legality. It's the optics.
Rose Hoban, North Carolina Health News, guest here on the WNZ Politics Podcast. I anticipate that there will be more to come from the North Carolina Senate on this in the weeks to come.
Yeah, think?
Yeah.
Actually, Senator Tucker has said that they're going to move on House Bill 403, which is a bill that would set out to limit, it gives the legislature levers to limit compensation on people like CEOs. So that's going to happen. And you'll see that soon.
Before we go, this is a total right turn, but that's what we do from time to time just for funsies. You spent about a year in Cambodia. Is that right?
No.
No.
No, no, no. I spent about a year in Thailand. During that time, I worked with Cambodian refugees.
What is your favorite Thai, Cambodian, Southeast Asian dish?
Oh, my God. Sometime. It's green papaya salad. Now, I can't say it because it would be like an advertisement. There is a restaurant in downtown Raleigh that makes a somtam that makes me want to cry.
You can tell me your favorite somtam restaurant in downtown Raleigh.
Bitamanda, man.
Okay.
Like, they're Lao. So I lived in northern Thailand, and then I did some work on the Thai-Cambodian border, but I lived in northern Thailand. And somtam is you shred coconut, and when you make it real life, right, like you put in a bunch of chilies, you put in tomatoes, and you pound it in a mortar and pestle, mm-hmm. and there's tamarind juice and lime juice and, of course, fish sauce. And then the real somtam, and this is what sets apart Bitamanda's somtam, I taste poo, which is fermented crab,
ooh.
And blara, which is fermented fish. And a lot of people, like, it's too strong a flavor for many Westerners, but, man, that stuff is the bomb. It's really good. So
good.
When I go looking, I could live on Bitamanda sometime. there's weeks when, like, the legislature is really intense, and I just sort of go, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and I call in an order, and I'll go over there, like, day after day and get, like, some.
What's the Cambodian word for podcast?
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay. How do you say goodbye in Cambodian?
Well, Thai.
In Thai, sorry.
Lagon.
Lagon.
Oh, well, actually, you just say Sawat Dee.
Sawat Dee. Oh, okay.
Sawat Dee, right? Yeah. You say hello, goodbye. It's Sawat Dee.
Sawat Dee. We'll chat more Thai next time you come on the podcast.
Dai.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for the updates. And we'll chat more soon.
All right. Sounds good.
That will do it for this edition of the WNC Politics Podcast. You can share the episode on Facebook or Twitter. And, of course, subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. For Rose Hoban, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Have a great weekend.